Annie ran the instant Natalia dropped the SSG into the snow. The bomb, with a little under 90 seconds remaining on the counter, ticked in her hands. She ran back along the side of the roadbed, at first in the direction of the retreat, glancing over her shoulder every chance she had, watching as Natalia drew off the personnel from the commandeered German helicopter. The wild card in the thing, she knew, was that the helicopter might go airborne in pursuit of Natalia. If it did, her gambit of using the bomb against the machine would prove impossible, and she'd be forced to pitch the bomb over into the defile paralleling the road. As she stumbled through a drift, she glanced at the timer. Only 74 seconds remained to detonation. She could no longer see Natalia, and there was no time to look for her. With a bomb under her left arm, as she'd seen men carry a football in videos at the retreat, Annie broke for the road, well away from the helicopter's personnel now, many of whom were on foot, chasing Natalia. A few stood perhaps 25 yards distant from the machine, as if not quite knowing what to do. Annie ran, which was difficult to do with the heavy snow. Raising her feet high enough to move at all was a challenge. 63 seconds on the timer.
Football!
She ran, shifting the laser-sighted Taurus from her right hand to her belt, hefting the bomb. But it wasn't light. There was the chance if she threw the bomb and it landed hard, it might detonate prematurely, but the snow was soft and she was running out of time. 55 seconds. The bomb in her hands, the helicopter 50 yards away. Annie ran, hauling her right arm back, her left hand still supporting the device as she drew her right hand level with her shoulder. She never paid that much attention to the football videos.
Throwing is throwing.
Annie pivoted on her left foot. She hurled the bomb toward the helicopter gunship. Then Annie turned, stumbling, catching herself, running now through the drifted snow covering the road, trying to retrace her original footprints as much as possible so she would have easier going. She couldn't glance back. There wasn't time. Natalia threw herself down into the drifted over rocks, hauled the M16 up, and fired out the last few rounds in the magazine. As she fired, she saw Annie running. About 15 to 20 meters from the German gunship, a fireball gushed up and out in all directions. Natalia saw Annie running, then throwing her body over the rocks at the side of the road and down into the drifts. The helicopter seemed to start moving, but too late. The fireball engulfed the gunship. The fireball, greater than before, belched up in a column of black smoke, consuming the helicopter. Natalia chambered the top round out of the fresh magazine in her M16 and opened fire on the Nazi personnel. Some of them dropped in the roadbed, some of them ran. And gunfire came from the edge of the roadbed. Annie. Natalia took one of the grenades from the musette bag she carried and yanked out the pin, hurling it toward the men clustered between her position and the incinerating helicopter. As the first grenade exploded, Natalia pulled the pin from a second one, threw it, then brought her M16 to her shoulder again. The Nazis from the gunship did little more than try to run for their lives and die. John Rourke loved his best friend like a son or brother, and loved his son like a brother or best friend. John was the most fortunate of men. He rested, eyes still closed, but he was awake now, summoning strength to be fully so as he assessed his body's condition. He felt weary in bone and muscle, but otherwise unimpaired. The weariness would pass. There was the smell of food cooking. Aboard the ATSAC, everything was microwaved. Like the coffee aboard the submarine vessels of Midwake, the coffee here was made in its own microwave device. The food packets, vastly better tasting and more nutritious than the old MRE, meal ready-to-eat type, were individually microwaved in units resembling large toasters.
Dad!
John opened his eyes.
Could you use something to eat?
John assumed Paul was at the ATSAC's controls and that already they were well away from the site of their battle with the Soviet armored missile unit.
Yeah, and you can stop yelling, Michael. My hearing seems to have returned to normal.
Great, let me help you sit up.
Oh, I'm a little woozy.
I gave you a very mild muscle relaxant sedative cocktail by injection. You've been asleep for 3 hours.
John shook his head. John took the packet. It became rigid during the cooking process, forming its lower side into a bowl, and peeled the spork off the side.
That's beef stew. Hey, I got cotton mouth. Give me something to drink, huh?
Right.
Rourke leaned back into the bulkhead as Michael went toward the service console.
Coffee? Water?
Right.
Michael foot-pedaled the cold water spigot, filling a cup.
We're well away from any Soviet activity, best we can tell. Paul and I agreed that radio silence would be a good bet, so we haven't contacted Captain Hartman's forces yet.
Rourke's son took the meal, exchanging it for the water. Then John dug back into his food. Regardless of the meal, food always seemed to taste better in the company of best friends.
After you get a shower, once you feel up to it, then maybe we can put our heads together and figure out the next step.
You and Paul seem to have things pretty well in hand. We have to get somewhere where we can contact Hartman's command for evacuation of the energy weapon by air without bringing the Russians down on us first.
Paul and I were talking, Dad. The Russians won't know we've got this, will they?
The thought had crossed Rourke's mind, too. If the energy weapon could be duplicated by utilizing the in-the-flesh article, along with the plans Vasily Prokopyev brought them at the behest of Antonovich, there might be a one-time surprise use advantage. Antonovich's motives, as Rourke understood them, were clear, however convoluted bringing them into reality might be. The Soviet military commander, one of the survivors from Karamazov's pre-Night of the War KGB elite corps, knew another nuclear confrontation was in the offing, unless he could give the Allies pitted against the Soviet underground city, the Americans of Midway, the surviving Icelandics, the first city Chinese, and the Germans, the means by which to achieve parity in the field without resorting to nuclear weapons.
What are you thinking about, Dad?
Rourke looked at his son and smiled. He was still a little fuzzy from the sleep and the sedative.
You were too young to remember then, but before the night of the war, there was a strong move afoot in the Soviet Union towards democratization, towards stepping down from a war footing. And things got out of hand, as you know. I was thinking about Antonovich, how possibly he's lived to regret what the KGB elite corps did behind the scenes to bring about the war. Maybe he's thinking that preventing a final round of nuclear destruction is worth the price.
Price?
Rourke nodded, putting down his food on the little fold-out table.
He'd rather have the Soviet underground city lose this war than win it and destroy the entire planet for good this time.
Sarah Rourke sat with her hands cupped around her swelling abdomen. Her arms formed something reminiscent of a collapsed ballet bubble, she thought. Maria walked into the great room from the room in which the young helicopter pilot was resting, a grim look on her beautiful face.
How is...
But then Sarah realized it was as if Annie already knew.
Dead?
Annie bit her lower lip, nodding.
So young. Wars are fought with the young, Annie. Remember?
Sarah stood up from the couch, her back aching, the palms of her hands pressing against her kidneys as she straightened up. Annie wore one of the ankle-length robes, the pink one, a dark blue towel turbaned over her hair. She sat down on the steps that led from the bedroom she shared with Natalia into the great room.
I'll get dressed. We need to bury him.
Natalia, her boots off but otherwise still attired for battle, lit a cigarette.
We cannot stay here any longer. We were very fortunate this time that we were able to kill them all. Good luck is never something to be counted on. If we remain at the retreat, there will be other Nazis sent after us, perhaps. Originally, Sarah, Rausch wanted to kill you because you killed his brother. But now, Annie and I have killed Rausch, and Annie recounted that Rausch told her she had killed a man who was very high up in their party. He was stupid or conceited enough to be carrying his party identification card on his body, and we found it when we searched him. His name was Hugo Gerdler.
Maria Leuden, sitting on the couch, took off her glasses.
Hugo Gerdler? Hugo Gerdler was one of the top-ranking men in the party. He was prominent in the youth, prominent under the leader, was likely more prominent among the hardliners. They will be after his killers.
We will be in no greater or lesser danger if we rejoin John and Paul and Michael. I vote that we leave here.
Sarah stood and leaned against the wall. She looked very tired.
I think we were pushed into this. Now, I thought that from the beginning. Sometimes, I guess, it's very nice to feel protected, but we have a duty just the same as the men. And I don't even feel like saying something cute about men getting in trouble without us there to keep them out of it.
Annie stood up, rearranging her robe.
If things come to a head, we should be where we can do the most good. I agree with Natalia that we won't be any safer here. And if Daddy and Paul and Michael are in danger, we don't have any right to try to keep ourselves out of everything just because we're women.
A lot of this was because of me, but I learned out there that I'm back like I was. Whether that's for good or for bad, I'm not any more or less likely to crack up than I would have been before what happened to me happened.
Huh? And party's over then.
Sarah felt as if a shackle suddenly let loose her spirit. The aircraft, a J-7V, came in almost diagonally over the pad near the main entrance of the mountain city that was the heart of New Germany in Argentina. And then it stopped. It hovered as its engines changed orientation, then began to descend. John Rourke looked below them. A granite jewel in the midst of a verdant subtropical paradise, the mountain islands inside which lay the German city rose from the center of a garden landscape. But unlike other times when Rourke came here, no children played in the park grounds, no women in soft print dresses strolled after them, no scholarly-looking young men walked deep in thought. Anti-aircraft missile batteries were set about the grounds instead, and all around were armored vehicles of every description from the German inventory. At each of the four corners of the pad onto which the J-7V was now settling stood tanks. Infantry personnel circled each tank. Some distance back, well away from the aircraft, Rourke saw horse-mounted, long-range mountain patrol personnel. The men and the animals they rode all but lost inside the shade of the single canopy jungle surrounding the park. There was a gentle lurch and the J-7V landed. John Rourke checked the bandages over his hands. Lighter, barely necessary now except to protect the fading wounds. New skin was already beginning to form, and most importantly, he could flex his fingers, hold a gun without opening the wounds and making them bleed again. After getting the ATSEC to a safe enough location to risk rendezvous with Captain Hartmann's forces in the field, they flew directly to the field headquarters. News of the Soviet weapon had already spread to New Germany, and scientific teams prepared for their arrival. 2 days were consumed with carefully dismantling the weapon for every conceivable form of photography, analysis, and data recording. Once the photos, x-rays, computer blueprints, and the other data were assembled and the weapon itself was reassembled, it was dispatched to New Germany, along with the original copy of the materials sent to them from the underground city's military commander via the exiled Vasily Prokopyev. Rourke spent several hours each of those 2 days undergoing skin grafts to his left hand. Gratefully now, the J-7V landed. Rourke stood. Doctors took skin from the rear of his left thigh, and he was still tender there. Copies of the accumulated data were dispatched to New Germany by various other flights, over various routes, so the data would arrive in good order, even if something were to befall the Soviet weapon itself. 2 more days were spent in travel, stopping first at Lidveldid Island to confer with Madame Jokli and her staff concerning the latest developments in the war, and, of course, to renew the friendship held by the entire Rourke family for Björn Rolvag. The Icelandic policeman asked to accompany them to the fighting. Rourke conveyed to Rolvag as best he could that they were on their way back from the active front in Eastern Europe to New Germany. Rolvag accompanied them in any event. They continued on to near Eden Base, where the women were waiting for them. Although he questioned the wisdom of their leaving the retreat, he would be glad to have their help, and on one level at least, felt more at ease if they were near. That if something occurred to endanger them, he would be there, rather than unknowing and thousands of miles away. Rourke could not escape the feeling that things were now coming to a head, a climax. As to the outcome, he could not predict. Michael walked aft from the J-7V's cockpit.
I just got off the radio. They want us inside, quick. One of the long-range mountain patrols reports Soviet troop movement toward the seacoast. There's some thought to the effect that the Soviets of the underground city might have already affected their alliance with their counterparts near Midwake, and some sort of seaborne attack might be in the offing.
If the alliance is already working, going inside might not help much.
John moved toward the fuselage door. Paul was already opening it, and when the almost uncomfortably bright sunlight washed into the cabin, Rourke squinted against it. There were German military personnel waiting, an honor guard with assault rifles at order arms, and other military personnel as well. From among the number of these latter, several assisted the rest of the way with the egress steps. Rourke reached into one of the patch pockets of his jacket. He pulled out the dark-lensed aviator sunglasses he hadn't needed very much in the blizzard conditions to the north. He needed them now. John moved down the steps, his pack in his right hand. One of the German junior officers reached for it, and Rourke let him take it. An M16 was secured to the pack. Rourke's gun belt was slung over his left shoulder.
God, it's bright out here!
The main entrance to the city lay before them. Armored vehicles nearly blocked it and sat positioned to do so rapidly. The blast doors were half closed. More than 5 times the usual number of guards stood at the ready. Just on the exterior side of the entrance stood a military band. Despite the dark-lensed glasses John wore, when he looked up, he squinted against the light. From the air, as the J-7V made its approach, he had detected little additional fortification of the German city. But from ground level, able to see beneath the overhangs that were blasted or laser-cut into the mountain's exterior, the city's level of preparedness seemed considerably heightened. Anti-aircraft and anti-armor missiles were located at regular intervals on three levels, and logic dictated that the armament surrounded the mountain in a staggered tier effect. Michael and Paul flanked him. Striding toward the aircraft from the edge of the landing field with several junior officers and a number of civilian official-looking men in tow came Colonel Wolfgang Mann. Colonel Mann, Supreme Military Commander of the Armed Forces of New Germany, saluted.
Herr General.
John Rourke, uncomfortable with the rank imposed on him by the President of Midwake, didn't know what to do for a moment. To salute in return, he thought, would be silly. He wore no uniform and considered his rank an honorary title more than anything else. Colonel Mann held the salute. John Rourke at last nodded.
Thank you, Colonel.
Mann lowered the salute. A little girl with long blonde ringlets and a very serious expression in her pretty blue eyes was shoved forward out of the crowd of dignitaries. She was so tiny that Rourke hadn't even noticed her until that instant. She wore a frilly white dress, like something for a formal birthday party, and in her hands she held flowers. She presented them to him, more or less forcing them toward his hands as he crouched down to her.
Oh, and thank you, too.
The door to the conference room opened, and an attractive young female officer, an aide to Colonel Mann, stepped in.
Herr General, the J-7V carrying Sarah Rourke, Natalia Tiemarovna, Mrs. Rubinstein, Maria Leuten, and Bjorn Rovag just landed safely.
The aide retired from the room, closing the door behind her. Dieter Bern, looking fragile, bent over the table. At the center lay the Soviet energy weapons, the one obtained by Jason Darkwood from Midwake, the second secured by Rourke, Paul, and Michael. Bern looked balefully at the weapons.
What a frightening object. Is it not, mein Herren?
But how much more frightening in the hands of the enemy alone?
John looked at his friend, nodding in agreement.
Sir, do your scientists think that the weapon can be duplicated in time to be of some use?
Dieter Bern's eyebrows shrugged as he looked up. The room was a formal meeting hall left over from the days of Nazi rule, and overlarge for their purposes, elaborate in the extreme. Black marble quarried in the mountains comprised the floor and the ceiling. Gray marble with yellow-gold molding adorned the walls. An immense crystal chandelier suspended from the ceiling directly over the simple, dark-stained wooden table shed light on the group.
Much to my personal regret, but out of necessity, our scientists labor long into each night on the design of weapons. As you no doubt are aware, or at least suspect, Herr Doctor, we have even developed thermonuclear warheads and are near completion in the development of long-range delivery systems. As a present, our weapons are crude by comparison to those that your generation used 5 centuries ago to nearly eradicate all life on Earth. But if the Soviets launch against us, we will at least be able to respond.
Mutually assured destruction is the term, sir. Many at that time saw considerable meaning in the English acronym the first letters of those three words form.
MAD.
Rourke nodded, staring at the energy weapons.
If this device can be perfected in time for use by your troops and the forces of Midwake, these energy weapons may give us the tactical and strategic advantage necessary to prevent that first launch. As we all know, as doubtless your scientists know, even the most modest nuclear exchange could so violently upset our fragile atmospheric envelope that all life on the surface would perish again, and the planet would never heal itself. Would life beneath the surface forever be life at all?
Dieter Bern splayed his long, age-gnarled fingers along the table.
Already, my friend, some of our scientists are laying the foundation necessary to support research into planetary re-engineering, much the same as was discussed in the context of the planet Mars before warfare between the superpowers so radically changed the course of human history. The principles would be more or less the same, only quite a bit simpler to bring about.
John looked first at Dieter Bern, then at Wolfgang Mann.
We're talking perhaps as long as a century to accomplish something such as that, at least in the light of your present technology. Planetary engineering, from what little reading I did in the field 5 centuries ago, worked marvelously well in computer models, but none of those models, even if they were available to you, would be accurate because of the obvious differences in the two planetary bodies. There'd also be the radiation factor to consider. How those portions of this planet currently uninhabitable and other portions that might be made so in a new nuclear exchange would bear on the desired results. In the final analysis, it's a tremendous gamble. Granted, it may prove necessary, but that possible option having to be exercised should be avoided at all costs.
The table was an elongated rectangle, and Michael stood silently at the far end for some time. He walked around the table now to be nearer to the devices as he spoke.
If your scientists could push this device to its logical limits, a weapon that could be hand-carried and fired and powered by a backpack unit of some type, we could use the weapon as a means of obtaining not just battlefield parity, but also a true advantage. What would happen, for example, if my father, Paul, and I, along with your top people and the top people from Midwake, penetrated the Soviet underground city, took it, and held it? The Soviet forces would be cut off from supply. And with more of these weapons in the field in German hands and in the hands of the Allied commando force that's been formed, we might be able to neutralize the Soviet conventional threat. If we launched a similar attack on the Soviet underwater complex, we might have a chance at effectively interdicting their use of submarine-launched missiles.
One thing that was an inescapable reality of the Cold War, Michael, and is a reality now, the primary mission of submarine warfare changed in the period following World War II, when submarines were used only to attack and disrupt shipping and surface maneuvers. Any such roles after the advent of submarine-launched intercontinental ballistic missiles became secondary to the primary mission of attacking land-based targets.
You see, the mission of the submarine during the Cold War and in our present situation is to stay hidden. Its conventional weapons array is primarily for defense. The submarine's very mobility is the threat, that it can't be neutralized before launch. During the Cold War, both sides used sophisticated satellites and other monitoring to track enemy submarines and plot their positions for interdiction in the event of conflict. Although surely there's still quite a bit of satellite material in orbit. Even if it were functional, there'd be no way to use it for tracking. German aircraft having the ability to cover the entire Pacific, let alone all the world's oceans, in search of enemy submarines. If the Soviets elect to launch a thermonuclear conflict predicated on the invulnerability of the submarine fleet, regardless of the morality concerning the effect on the planet, the logic from a military standpoint is impeccable. Midwake has historically fielded a smaller fleet, and its submarines have no nuclear delivery capability. Our only prayer in the event that the Soviets elect to use SLICBMs against us would be the Midwake fleet taking out the Soviet fleet. The chances for effectively accomplishing the task without one missile or an entire missile battery launching would be too low to bother calculating.
Are you saying then, Dr. Rourke, John, that we have lost the war before it has begun?
No. I'm saying we're all saying that we need to strike before they can strike. And even at that, our chances for success are slim. That's the reality of the situation. The Soviet presence near Midwake in the Pacific has become the wild card, gentlemen. If the Soviets of the underground city can manipulate things so there's a coordinated offensive incorporating land forces and the Soviet submarine fleet, we're in very deep trouble.
This had to be the crucial meeting because it was being held in the official hall of the Triumvirate. 3 very tired-looking old men, the rulers of this Soviet civilization beneath the surface of the Pacific Ocean. Nikolai Antonovich sat at the conference table, his eyes drifting over the gray-black marble walls and toward the long desk that dominated the far end of the vaulted chamber. Pillars of marble, perhaps, supported the roof structure. The desk stood empty now, nor did anyone sit behind it. When he first came here days ago, and after days of negotiation there on the surface, first on the platform, then inside one of the monstrously sized Soviet submarines, he saw the 3 men. They reminded him of party officials from 5 centuries ago, the men who worked behind the scenes and behind the backs of the leaders who realized the absurdity of global war. They reminded him of the leader of the Soviet underground city. Possessed by their own ability to wield power, they were its prisoners. Here, Soviet society continued to decline to almost a Stalinist military dictatorship. The citizens lived relegated to the status of workers within a colony of ants or bees. No one other than him had ever seen an ant or a bee, because no one here remembered the old days, had endured cryogenic sleep carrying him from the horror of the present to the horrors of the future. Antonovich had once been a loyal communist, and in his heart still believed in communism. It was the men who practiced it, who ruled through it, who were the ones that corrupted it. But did not mankind corrupt all that it touched? Antonovich suddenly wondered what he was doing here. He had come for the sole purpose of effecting an alliance that would bring about the destruction of mankind. He knew that just as surely as he knew that if he did not do this thing, the next man behind him would forge the alliance in his stead. Dr. Svetlana Alexova sat opposite him, chatting gaily with the Soviet military leaders. Each night, she shared his bed. But he would not, at least in the figurative sense, turn his back on her. She served the state and herself. He was only her tool. Behind the desk, the wall of marble was smooth. But he knew that set within the wall was a door, all but seamless. Marshal Antonovich watched for the three men to emerge from that portion of the wall. Then the final round of talks would begin. They would share the power, thus dividing the earth, the spoils of this war to end all wars forever, because there would be no one left alive to fight another war. The situation would have been humorous in a black comedy sense. A group of vile little boys planning to divide a ball into segments after playing and winning a game that would destroy the ball forever. Yet no one understood that as he did. To them, the chance of destruction was a risk to be taken. To Nikolai Antonovich, destruction was not a risk. Destruction was a certainty. There was to be a formal dinner tonight, Natalia learned shortly after their arrival. The people of New Germany and Argentina did not use money. Rather, like something out of the science fiction novel so popular in the 20th century, exchange of goods and services occurred through a system of credits, hence credit cards. She accepted a credit card, identical to those, save for the names and registration numbers given to Sarah, Annie, and Maria. Sarah and Maria went off together, leaving Natalia alone with Annie. Alone, save for the seemingly thousands of other souls milling about the streets and byways of the German city. After all her time in open spaces, Natalia found the crowds unnerving. She wore the only decent clothes she had brought with her, having thought more along the lines of fighting than shopping. Now, for once, she saw some advantages to Annie's more normally formal attire. Except when situations demanded otherwise, even in the field, Annie wore a skirt. As they walked down the street, Natalia looked at Annie and smiled.
Isn't this absurd?
Shopping? You used to be able to shop. I've never been able to shop. What do?
Well, you walk around the store and pretend as if you're disinterested, but always politely disinterested. A salesperson comes up to you and asks if you need help. You tell her you're just looking, and she tells you to call if you need any assistance. You keep walking around, and then the saleswoman comes up to you again, asks what you're looking for. You tell her in general terms, and she immediately shows you something she thinks would look perfect for your purposes. Then you tell her you're still just looking around, and you eventually find something you want to try on. Well, then you find the saleswoman, and she shows you where to change, and when you come out wearing it, she tells you it looks lovely on you.
What if it doesn't?
That's why they have mirrors.
Michael Rourke considered his options as he cleaned his pistols. All of his options, of course, were predicated on survival of the coming battles for the domination of the Earth. If his side won, then what? He was a grown man of 30 years old, with no truly marketable skills other than those related to warfare. He told himself, ever since his father awakened them, spent 5 years with them, and then returned to the sleep, someday he would be a doctor like his father.
Will it ever happen?
New Germany made his concerns all the more real. Here in New Germany existed probably the finest medical school on the planet. Even without competition, it was more advanced by far than anything existing in the days his father attended school. And here, in New Germany, Maria Leuden blossomed in her familiar surroundings where she belonged. He loved her, but did he belong here? Could he belong anywhere?
Do I love her enough?
For the thousandth or millionth or billionth time, Michael Rourke opened his wallet and studied one photograph there. Madison, beautiful in her wedding dress, standing beside him. He always thought she looked like the popular concept of an angel, and now she was among them, apart from him forever. Or, if there was a heaven and by some fluke, with all the death and destruction to his credit, he was admitted there, apart from her until his death. In an odd way, a way in which he somehow felt ashamed for even considering, he was somewhat comforted that she was not alone. Their unborn child went to death with her. He'd sometimes pictured himself, if somehow Madison died after the birth of their child, what would he have told his son or daughter about their mother? She was simply lovely, gentle, loving, and she returned to the place of her origin with the angels, where she waited, watching over them. Tears filled Michael's eyes. He sat down on the edge of the bed in his room.
Madison.
The two women, pausing before the shop window, looked more or less like all the other women on the streets of the city, except perhaps that they were prettier than most. One of them, the tall one, with the almost black, just past shoulder-length hair, wearing a white blouse, nearly ankle-length khaki skirt, and carrying an enormous black cloth shoulder bag, was exquisite. Major Natalia Anastasia Tyamarovna, Committee for State Security of the Soviet. The other woman showed much longer, dark, honey-colored hair, cascading to her trim waist. She reminded him of photos he saw in history books of the decadent 20th-century hippies of post-war Germany and America, her dress as long as the major's skirt and an explosion of autumnal colors. Peeking out from beneath its hem were boots, a long, wide scarf draped over one of her shoulders, in a red so deep it was almost the color of blood. She carried a purse, but somehow looked awkward with it. Otherwise, she was as beautiful as the darker-haired major, just more juvenile, less sophisticated. Perhaps there was, in fact, a means of accounting for this Annie person's marriage to the Jew, Rubinstein. Did the blood of an equally inferior race flow through her veins, that of gypsies? He thought gypsies extinct, but supposedly they exhibited wild looks and wild ways. The Annie person was laughing. He nodded to Carl, who watched from the other side of the street. Carl removed his hat, ran his fingers back through his thinning hair, the signal, and moved off. He watched the two women for a moment longer. With the shoulder bags they carried, they might well be armed. That would make no difference. Carl was not a pleasant fellow, but he was very efficient at killing. It was Carl who assassinated the wife of the traitorous Wolfgang Mann, not far from here, really, killing two of the traitorous Dieter Behrend's soldiers in the course of his escape. Carl, indeed, had a knack for his work. Enjoyed it. The two women moved on and paused before another shop window, talking, both laughing, it seemed. Then, the one who fornicated with the Jew, Rubinstein, did something with her clothes, turning around a full 360 degrees. Both women laughed again. They hugged each other briefly as they laughed. Lesbians? That thought amused him. The two women went inside the shop. He watched the shop for a moment longer, then walked away.
Oh, I like this. Well, for you, I mean.
Annie looked at Natalia's pretty blue eyes, her face. But Natalia was looking at the dress rather oddly.
Don't you like it?
Annie, I just don't think it's me, that's all.
Well, you'd look sensational in green.
The beadwork. I mean, I just don't think so.
Oh. You want to look more like a princess than a party girl. Fine, we'll both look like princesses.
Annie took an off-white formal from the rack, swept it in front of her dramatically, and threw her left arm up and back.
Oh, my dear, aren't we just too divine?
Be serious a little, or we'll never find anything in time to wear tonight.
Right.
Annie caught a movement just beyond the window, there on the walkway. Why was a man staring so intently into a dress shop? He walked on.
What's wrong?
Some guy outside, that's all.
Natalia turned around and glanced toward the windows.
I don't see him.
Oh, never mind. Oh, look at this!
Annie took another dress from the rack of formals. It was blue, plain, and elegant.
Talk about princesses.
So far, Natalia had spotted five men. She was tempted to go to the first German policeman or soldier and report it. But if there were to be an attack, and it would be unfocused because it occurred off schedule, many innocents might die. Just because someone, a soldier, a police officer, carried a firearm, there was no reason to suppose that person would be wonderfully proficient in its use. She and Annie could leave the shopping area and get themselves out of harm's way, but postponing the inevitable was nothing Natalia relished. If an attack were aimed at them, a similar attack might be aimed at Sarah and Maria. The thing to do was force the situation. For that, she must make both Annie and herself appear as vulnerable as possible, and fast. The store was called Olga's, and had, by far, the finest selection of any they visited. There was a beautiful white dress, but Natalia had no tan, and the color would only make her appear paler than she usually looked. She found the perfect thing in black. Despite her height, it seemed as though, with a few quick alterations, it would be ideal. Annie found a dress as well, also in black.
Oh, we shouldn't. It will be fun wearing the same color. Let's try them on.
There were closet-sized booths at the rear of the store, with doors similar to those used in restrooms. The doors and walls started about 10 inches off the floor, so the legs of the person behind them were visible. Built in a freestanding block side by side, each shared a common wall with the next. They were positioned just a short distance from a rear wall of the shop, behind which probably lay some sort of storage area. The idea that came to Natalia when they first entered the store was now set. They walked toward the changing area.
There are 5 of them, I think, and they'll try to kill us while we're changing. You're wearing boots, so you'll have to be the maneuver element.
They stopped beside a table and examined junk jewelry.
When we get into the booths, we'll be side by side. If we can't get 2 next to one another, we'll find something else to look at and wait. When we get inside, we talk, just loud enough so that anyone listening will know we're inside. You get out of your boots and leave them standing in the exact center of the space, so anyone looking from the front will see them, think you're in them. I'll keep talking to you after you leave and let my skirt drop to the floor.
Where am I going?
Crawl out under the back wall of the booth, lose yourself in the racks, and get a position of concealment from which you can observe the entrance and the booths. When the men rush in, open up on them, and I'll open fire from the booth. We'll have them in a crossfire, neat and clean.
You could get killed.
We can't have that. I wouldn't get to wear this dress.
All right.
There were 2 booths, side by side. Natalia and Annie walked toward them, entering the booths, but not too quickly. Natalia closed the door behind her.
Annie?
Yes?
Do you still have those black pearls?
Annie didn't have any black pearls.
And I brought them with me, too.
Oh, good. They'll look wonderful with your dress or mine.
Natalia looked toward the floor. Stocking-footed, Annie was crawling out under the back partition. Natalia kicked out of her shoes.
You know, it was really good luck coming in here, Annie.
She had the suppressor-fitted stainless steel PPKS American out of her purse, hanging it by the trigger guard on a hook on the partition nearest her right hand. She unbuttoned the waistband of her skirt, thumbed it down over her hips, and shrugged the garment to the floor around her ankles. She reached into the neckline of her blouse and tucked the solitary spare magazine she had for the PPKS into her cleavage.
I wish we'd known about this banquet tonight. I don't even have any good shoes. We're going to have to find some, Annie. What?
She paused for an instant as if listening to Annie.
That's a good idea.
She had 1 of the 2 evening gowns in her left hand, the one she wasn't planning on buying, just in case it took a stray bullet, and her pistol in her right hand. The little 380's slide-mounted thumb safety up and off.
Oh, all right, you can use it, but I thought you didn't like that scent.
She hoped if the men were already in the store and listening, her conversation sounded vacuous enough. She peered through the crack between the door and the side wall, and she thought she saw men's shoes near a rack of hostess skirts. Annie crouched about 20 feet away.
Now, Natalia!
Natalia kicked the stall door open and threw herself left and down, going into a roll. Annie brought down the first man as Natalia pulled the Walther's trigger through double action and brought down another, brandishing an M16. Annie and Natalia's simultaneous shots dropped a third man, holding a Beretta 92F in both hands as he turned to fire on Natalia. The last 2 men broke for the doors. Annie fired, then fired again. One of the men pitched forward through the window glass and onto the sidewalk, but he picked himself up, stumbling into a run at the heels of the other man. Natalia ran after him, jumping over one of the dead men, careful of her stockinged feet as she ran past the broken glass into the pedestrian walkway. The few private vehicles were already knotting into what would pass for a traffic jam here, and jaws dropped as faces turned toward her. A woman in a blouse with only the bottom part of a silk teddy covering the lower portion of her body, a gun in her hand. The wounded man tripped and fell, pushing a pistol toward her. Natalia moved into a crouch and held the Walther in both hands. She fired again, then again. The last man turned toward her. Natalia dropped to the pavement.
Watch out! He's got a hostage!
Natalia changed magazines for the PPKS as she rolled over the curb and into the street, coming up on both knees, the pistol at maximum extension of both arms.
Don't!
The last of the assassins sent against Natalia and Annie, his fedora askew, held the muzzle of a Beretta 92F to the head of a woman about Natalia's own age. The woman shuddered, pregnant and terrified. Police and soldiers raced into the street. The unwavering assassin held the woman before him as a shield. Annie, stocking-footed, was walking forward slowly, her Scoremaster 45 held in a point-shoulder position.
Fräulein, drop your gun!
I am Natalia Temerovna! Do not interfere here, or your Colonel Mann will hear of it! Send personnel to find Sarah Rourke and her party! There may be an assassination team ready to assault them! Do it now!
I said drop your gun! Drop it now!
Natalia rose slowly from her knees, the muzzle of the Walther still aimed at the assassin's head.
Damned hat!
Without the hat, she could have gotten a clear enough idea of the actual size of the assassin's head so she could shoot him there.
Annie! Come up slowly and keep to your side, right?
If you attempt to...
To do what? You'll kill her? Then you'll die! If you don't lay down that pistol now, then you will die! If you do lay it down, I promise you your life, if you cooperate.
She tried to read what kind of a man this was. Was he insane enough to kill his pregnant hostage and go down in a hail of bullets? Or was there enough rationality left to him that he would take this one chance? If she could keep him talking, even just a little longer, there was always the chance he might surrender, but a better chance still that she could make a killing shot. He held a Beretta. How did they get these American military weapons stored for the Returning Eden Project? The Beretta was cocked, his right first finger inside the guard and resting against the trigger. A shot to the elbow would have the best chance of success against an involuntary reflex triggering the shot to the head of the hostage.
I will kill her, Fräulein Major!
Then I will kill you! You are not dealing with police, the military, anyone in this but Annie and me! We don't negotiate or listen to demands! You will surrender, or you will die here, Nazi!
Don't come any closer!
Natalia felt that she was close enough.
Let her go and you live! My word as an officer!
There was indecision in his eyes, not in Natalia's. She wanted him alive. The Walther bullet hit the underside of the man's elbow. The Beretta flew from his grasp as his hostage fell to the ground. The assassin dropped back, his left hand sweeping up from under his jacket. Natalia's silenced Walther PPKS and Annie's 45 barked in chorus. The police and the military were all over the body. The pregnant woman pulled away as though she were still in danger. Natalia looked to the left, then the right. Annie stepped back. Natalia interposed her thumb between the Walther's hammer and the rear face of the slide and worked the safety to drop the hammer, rolling her thumb out as it fell.
In that case, we must...
The meeting in the underwater city's vast hall dragged on without end. Antonovich waited for a break between the triumvirate principal's sentences.
Comrades, it would seem to me, if I might interject, that a very simple situation confronts us.
All three of the triumvirate members looked at him. Across the table from him, Dr. Alexova smiled, a pretty smile. Her eyes bored into him. Antonovich pressed on before one of the other two triumvirate members began another long monologue, or the leader resumed the one Antonovich interrupted.
We are all communists. We are all Russians. So why do we waste valuable time and energies in this debate? Already, I have been given to understand several vessels of your submarine fleet have crossed through the Drake Passage and stationed themselves in the South Atlantic, off the Argentine coast.
The naval officer sitting beside Svetlana Alexova turned indignant.
The area you refer to as the Drake Passage, Conrad General, is known as the Stolen Passage.
Antonovich smiled at the hardline communist, A man the same as he dealt with at the underground city. They had to be, to memorialize a dictator like Joseph Stalin.
As you say, Comrade Admiral, the Stalin passage. But with your vessels in position for attack on New Germany, would not all of our interests be better served by planning what should transpire rather than debating future global politics?
The head of the triumvirate, as dour-faced and gray a man as Antonovich ever saw, rose to the debate.
Comrade General Antonovich, we are aware of the military urgency to which you allude, but we are not mercenaries, fighting for a cause because of some capitalistic profit motives, nor do we send our gallant young communists into battle merely in answer to a request. No. There must be covenants between our communist brothers on the land and ourselves. Without such agreements, our fleet will not fire, will not support your land forces. And without our thermonuclear weapons, comrade, the people of your underground city cannot triumph, will go down in defeat.
Antonovich lit a cigarette. He lit it partially because he wanted one, partially because he knew that smoking irritated the head of the triumvirate.
Comrades, must I remind you that if we, your brothers, as you have so generously referred to us, should be defeated, then the combined forces engineering that defeat will be able to turn their full attentions to you in aid of their ally Midwake. And then what? With backs to the wall, you will utilize your nuclear warheads, and if the evidence our scientists and the scientists of our enemies have amassed proves true, you make the Earth forever uninhabitable. Not just the surface atmosphere will disappear, but the oceans themselves will vaporize this time. How long would your underwater complex last here? A few seconds? No. The only way in which there can be a communist victory without bringing about the destruction of humanity as a species, comrades, is by combining our forces now, using your submarine fleet as the launching platforms for missiles carrying conventional warheads to devastate our common enemies and bring them to their knees. Otherwise, we are all dead, all of us, on both sides.
Antonovich did not like the way Svetlana Alexova looked at him. By the time John Rourke heard what had happened, he also had full information concerning the results of the assassination attempt. No team went after Sarah and Maria. The killers, sent to murder Natalia and Annie, were dead. John dressed for the ridiculous dinner party planned in his honor.
I got better things to do than this. All right now, temper, John.
Though Rourke was technically a general, he owned no uniform, nor would he wear one if he did. Hence, he fell back to the uniform of formal dinner parties for nearly six centuries now, the tuxedo. In the five centuries since he last wore one, nothing changed. Five centuries ago, lapels swung pendulum fashion from wide to narrow again, then back to wide. And shirt collars went from the wing type, which he personally detested, to more standard collars, then back to the wings. Two tailors from New Germany's most exclusive men's clothiers arrived at the unnecessarily large apartment provided for his use, bringing with them a large variety of formal clothes. After realizing it was childish to protest, Rourke submitted to the inevitable, but selected from among the clothes the most conservative, those closest to the solitary tuxedo he owned before the night of the war. Black, the lapels of a medium width, he eschewed a cummerbund just as vigorously now as then, in favor of a vest. Why did they insist he needed a half dozen shirts? They were plain front, requiring studs, and had the standard type of collar featured on those designed for less splendiferous purposes. The ties, three, were neither ultra small nor the size of a mutated butterfly, but essentially identical to the tie he wore five centuries ago. He had, of course, opted now, as then, for the sort of tie one tied oneself. And, just as five centuries ago, a tuxedo was damnably difficult for hiding any sort of substantial handgun. A curious coincidence, he thought, reflecting on it now as he knotted his tie. But when John, Paul, and Michael stopped at the retreat to pick up Sarah, Natalia, Annie, and Maria during the course of a fast inspection of the retreat systems, he checked the gun cabinets. More than just the glass case that was in the open in the great room, but the other storage areas as well. He stored a CAR-15 he no longer had the luxury of carrying in its proper place, returning the Colt lawman 2-incher as well. Since he no longer carried a companion 357 Magnum revolver, his Metalifed and Magnaported Python was damaged beyond easy repair some time ago. He noticed a handgun he thought might prove useful, one of the last guns he acquired before the night of the war. He bought it for practical as well as emotional reasons back then. When he occasionally conferred with an influential friend at Smith & Wesson, he asked the same questions apparently many thousands of other Smith & Wesson fans had on their minds.
Any plans to produce the old Centennial model in stainless steel?
When the gun eventually came out that way, sans grip safety and in the more rust-resistant form, Rourke held out for some time, telling himself there were better things he could spend his money on than another firearm. But in the end, he bought it. The Centennials were tested for +P+, so he could safely fire ordinary +P-38 special ammunition through the gun. Although the handgun came with nicely figured, smooth Goncalo Alves stocks, he immediately removed these and substituted a Barami hip grip. The hip grip, on those rare occasions when he would carry a short-barreled J or K-frame revolver, always proved itself as the most easy to conceal. Before he closed up the case in which he found the Model 640 Centennial, he decided to take it along. A modest supply of the new manufacture 38 Special made for him by the Germans, but to the exact specifications of the old Federal 158-grain semi-wad-cutted lead hollow-point +P loading, a spare set of the hip grips, a solitary Safariland J-frame speed loader, and he was set. He stashed the gun in his pack for some future use as an emergency hideout. The bow tie knotted, John went to the pack that lay at the foot of one of the two double beds. Sarah would return to their room in a few moments, but he had a meeting to attend before the banquet, so time was of the essence. He took the Centennial from the pack, checked it for functional reliability, loaded it with five of the SWLHPs, then slipped the revolver on its hip grip into the beltless waistband of his trousers. He took the A.G. Russell Sting 1A Black Chrome from the dresser top where his other weapons lay and then secured knife and sheath near the small of his back. As Rourke was about to slip into his jacket, the door to the apartment opened and he left the bedroom. It was Sarah. She wasn't ready yet, of course, but looked lovely nonetheless. Her hair, not quite as long as Annie's, was softly arranged, drawn back at the nape of her neck. She was dressed simply, as was her habit, in a pretty pastel floral print maternity top. Something Annie made for her, surely. A blue skirt and low-heeled shoes.
Hi.
Hi.
Annie and Natalia, that was terrible. Annie told me all about it. Thank God they were together.
Yeah. You look very pretty.
You look pretty.
John didn't know what to say.
So I'll see you at dinner.
Yes.
She walked toward the bedroom. John deferred to her as she went through the doorway, then followed her. She stopped before the dresser.
You're leaving your Detonix 45s?
Well, it won't carry under a tuxedo unless it's tailored for them or the jacket's a couple of sizes too large, at least in the shoulder holsters.
She turned around and looked at him as he slipped into his coat. Sarah stepped up to him and put the palms of her hands against his chest.
What are we gonna do? I mean, if we lose this big battle everyone's starting to talk about, we don't have to worry about it. But if we win...
I love you. And I have always loved you.
And you love Natalia too, John. I know that. And in a way, I've come to accept that.
Rourke folded Sarah into his arms. He touched his lips to her forehead.
You're my wife.
Consolation prize?
I never said that.
You know the interesting thing, John? I can really understand why you love her. She's extraordinary. Not just the way she looks or what she can do, but she's extraordinary.
And so are you.
She leaned up and kissed him lightly on the mouth.
Big deal what I can do, John, or anything else about me. But she's so much like you. And maybe she's just a little bit better. And maybe that's what's so intriguing about her.
He didn't know what to say. He never knew what to say in these moments.
You gave me two fine children.
Sarah touched her abdomen gently.
Three. And you love me. It's all right that you love Natalia, John. It wasn't your fault. Whatever you decide, I know it'll be the right thing for all of us.
John John Rourke held her tight and kissed her hair, remembering why he first told her he loved her more than 5 centuries ago. Some things did not change. John Rourke entered the meeting hall. A half-dozen German long-range mountain patrol guards, under the command of a senior sergeant, stood guard at the doors. Rourke entered without question. Seated in a chair, wearing his dress uniform, Jason Darkwood nodded to John. Standing beside him, arms still in a sling, Sam Aldridge in Marine Corps dress blues. Otto Hammerschmidt stood by the window, deep in discussion, it seemed, with Colonel Mann, both German officers in dress uniform. Neither Michael nor Paul had arrived yet, nor Dieter Bern. Rourke crossed to Jason Darkwood in 3 long strides. Darkwood started to stand.
Relax, Captain. How you feeling?
Full of antibiotics, bandaged in a few uncomfortable places, and a little tired. But okay.
I know the feeling.
Rourke started to offer his right hand to shake, but remembered he'd just removed the bandages from both his hands less than an hour ago.
Forgive me.
He nodded toward his hands.
Still a little tender.
Really? You're out of uniform, General.
Yeah, right. And that's the way I intend to stay. Remember, a general has a right to make his own uniform, which means I'm not out of uniform at all now, am I?
Touché.
The doors to the chamber opened for Michael and Paul to enter. Rourke stared at them. He'd never seen either man in a tuxedo. Seeing his son dressed that way was an experience he doubted he'd ever forget.
My God, he's grown up.
Dad, Dr. Byrne will be along in a little while. One of his aides met us in the corridor.
Thanks, son.
Rourke studied Paul's and Michael's attire more clinically. Where were Michael's Beretta 92Fs? Where was Paul's Browning High Power? He gave them each high marks for concealment, knowing neither of them would travel unarmed any more than he would. John looked away, not wanting to find the spots where they hid their guns.
Well, gentlemen, a party coming up. How nice, and how utterly useless.
Wolfgang Mann turned from the windows where he still stood.
Yes, but the habiliments of civilization are important at times, aren't they, Herr Doctor?
Rourke looked over his shoulder toward Mann and smiled.
I suppose, but I'll confess I'd enjoy the prospects of this banquet more if it were some purpose other than what I understand it's to be.
You will be awarded the Knight's Cross, Herr Doctor. Few men have earned such a distinction.
Rourke did not know he was to receive a medal.
What? Oh, look, I don't want to...
You didn't know!
Mann left the company of Otto Hammerschmidt and crossed the room to Rourke.
Forgive me, Herr Doctor.
You're forgiven, but I really don't.
I knew, and so did Michael. I mean, John, without you, who of us would be here? The German Republic would still be a Nazi dictatorship, and... Well, if anyone deserves a medal, you do.
John Rourke looked at his friend, then down at his hand.
All I ever did.
Before Rourke could complete his thought, the doors opened again and Dieter Bern entered, looking withered in an ill-fitting, overlarge tuxedo that, like its wearer, appeared to have seen better days.
Gentlemen, it appears from our latest reconnaissance overflights that the Russians have stationed several of their undersea boats off our coastline.
John Rourke looked at Colonel Mann.
And this is the time for a party?
If they intend the use of nuclear missiles, we are all dead. If not, it is their move in any event. I suggest that we use the evening to its fullest potential, gentlemen. Tonight we live, for tomorrow we may die.
John Thomas Rourke looked at his son, at his friend, then at his son again. What sort of life had Michael lived? A dead wife and baby? A mistress? Was that all? He looked at his friend, his son-in-law. What had Paul and Annie shared? John closed his eyes for a moment.
They lived all that life allows them. It's time I do the same.